Welcome to the Ludogogi Podcast, your monthly games-based learning earworm. We're your hosts. I'm Antonis.
And I'm Sarah. And today's guest is Ray Najardi. Ray is the creative force behind Sword Queen Games, and he believes in the power and magic of creative play, which is something he definitely has in common with Ludogogi. Ray is Filipino-Algerian and lives in the Philippines, a place whose myths and legends provided the inspiration for the game Balik Bayan, a cyberpunk supernatural storytelling game, which was nominated for an Indie Game Developer Network Groundbreaker Award. Identity, this month's theme, is clearly important in Ray's games design practice, and he has stated that themes of queerness and post-colonialism often make their way into the games through his experience and identity, and that he believes that marginalised creators are the future of TTRPGs. A few of the many games that Ray has designed includes one of my favourites, Our Haunt, a cosy, creepy tabletop RPG about a family of ghosts built on the belonging-outside-belonging system. The Dying World, a game which uses tarot cards to generate character and story. And a game which is firmly at the top of my list to play next, Apocalypse Keys, where players are monsters attempting to hold back the apocalypse. Ray also has the distinction of being our most frequently nominated future guest by the previous guests of the podcast. Welcome, Ray. So one of the things we like to do with our guests before we begin our interview proper is to ask them about an interesting fact about themselves that some people might not know about them. So take it away.
Yeah. So something interesting about me is that I've been reading tarot cards for more than 25 years. And my last full-time job before becoming a full-time TTRPG person was being a tarot reader, a Reiki shaman practitioner. So in general, my resume is a mess. There's like a wild shift between each career path. But it's really funny that I landed from tarot and Reiki and I'm now here in TTRPGs, a different form of magic, probably.
So many of your games feature tarot cards as well, though, which is something that I really like about them, actually, because it gives you an excuse to get these wonderful sort of tactile and beautiful objects out when you play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I really love tarot cards, and I really feel like we're barely scratching the surface of like how to use them in play. Like, I think one of my favorite games that does it really well while creating their own card system is Spindle Wheel. Like, it feels more like the way you actually use tarot cards and interpret them. So I try to do something like that where the tarot card is not just a die that is split between cards. It is instead like something you interpret and interact with is what I try to do. I feel like I haven't quite gotten it yet, but it's fun to try.
Yeah, it's not an indie game, but something I remember playing, and I was absolutely horrified I think it's its 30th anniversary recently, and it's on my shelf. Everway.
Everway, yes.
Everway?
Yes, yes.
Yes, yeah. And that was probably the first game that I played that had a tarot-like mechanism. Like, it's really beautiful, but yeah. Horrifying that it's 30 years old.
I know.
People get old and their stories get older. So that's something to play with.
Mm.
Yeah. And has the rest of your messy, as you said, CV informed your game design career, right?
Oh, yeah, totally. So I was also a studio photographer for a while. So I feel that like help create the visual language that's important to me when I lay out games. I was also a soft skill trainer / English second language teacher. So I think that also informs how it's important to me to teach people how to play games through the text and the struggle of like a book that is good to read, but also teaches you how to play the game, but also evokes how you play the game and is also easy to reference is like a huge challenge, but I think my training background helped with that. Like there's a lot of jobs that all have prepared me for TTRPGs. It feels like multi-classing. Am I allowed to talk about multi-classing on a indie podcast? Is that
sure? With some care.
this one token. one moment.
No, we encourage people to talk about whatever they want to talk about.
And we're definitely not judgmental.
Definitely.
So, Ray, how do you get ideas for games apart from your past, which looks like a very rich past?
Yeah, no, oh my gosh. So the problem is I cannot stop having ideas. My partner recognizes it when it happens, when we're watching a TV show or watching a movie or I'm reading a book. He says, oh no, love, you have that game design look on your face again. You're thinking about it again. There are shows and media that I can't consume because I keep thinking, oh, this would be a really good game, but I don't have the energy and the time to work on it. Like, for example, I used to be able to watch My Hero Academia, the anime, because I used to tell myself, well, there's masks, so I don't have to think about what this is like as a TTRPG. But then the series started to really lean into the themes of generational trauma, and it started to, the Pulse Ultra thing felt like a mechanic that wasn't represented in masks. And I was like, oh no, I'm starting to think about it. I didn't survive a few Godzilla movies because those are too easy to turn into games. Definitely. So, and a really challenging one. So yeah, my problem is like, I can't stop thinking about it. I was surprised when I found out that other people don't have that same problem.
I'm totally with you. I have that problem.
Yeah, me too.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. There's a way I love trying to break down something into narrative structure and mechanics. I love trying to translate what I'm seeing on screen or what I'm experiencing in life and how it would look like as a mechanic. I just love thinking about that. It's one of my favorite things to do.
So the skill, I suppose, that needs to be developed there is not having ideas, but prioritizing, categorizing and sorting and putting them in nice little boxes and working out when you're going to give them the time.
Exactly. And this is something that Jay Dragon brought up on this podcast before, that you have, the more you work on these games and projects, the less time and energy you have. Like, they kind of get bigger and bigger and bigger. Like, my friends tease me that I am incapable of designing a small game. I tried to make a small OSR hack last year in November with Josh Hitty. We've been working on this game every week since then. Like, we haven't finished. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger. I'm so disappointed in myself, but it's about space pirates. So definitely it is the challenge of trying to be patient. But that's also why I love talking about ideas with people. I just love sharing it and talking about it with other designers and talking about it online, because I think ideas are easy to come by. It's the execution that's a different thing entirely. And so if someone wants to take an idea and execute it for themselves, it becomes their game, right? I feel no possession over it. I like it when someone takes my idea and does their own thing, because if ever, I can always come back to it in the future and still do it in my own way, and that's totally fine. So
with that kind of in mind, do you have a favorite game mechanic, and if so, what is it? Have you used it in your games, and how did it work out?
I can talk about mechanics literally for hours. I just get super nerdy. There was one time I talked about the engagement role mechanic from Blades in the Dark for 4 hours straight with someone. I didn't know you could talk about that single mechanic for 4 hours, but we apparently did. But it is related to my favorite game mechanic. I normally like mechanics and the way they like interlace and connect to each other and speak to each other and inform each other. I think one of the most beautiful things about TTRPGs is that it's so many elements coming together, both player, designer, GM, but also the mechanics, like everything syncing up at once. And I feel that one of the most important core mechanics that I always fall back to over and over again as a foundation is questions. And I think it's because it's a way that a designer can express to the players, these are the themes of the game that I'm focused on. This is what's important to me. as a designer, but I want to invite you and your input. I trust in you and your imagination and your creativity and your intuition to answer those questions. Oh, now I wonder if it's connected to tarot readings, now that I think about it, because a really good tarot reading...
Or your background in learning.
That's you. Oh my gosh, it's all coming together. But because like as a tarot, when I was teaching tarot, I would often tell my students that how good your question is how good the reading will be, right? And so if you ask, am I going to get this job? It's not a good question compared to what can I do to get the career that would fulfill me the most, right? It's like two completely different readings. And it's the same with game design. Like the way you ask a question to the players. My favorite trick is to create a question that has another sub question that's like hidden inside it. I think, for an example, in Apocalypse Keys, which has been, people have accused it of being the polycule simulator. I will not confirm or deny any of those allegations, but one of the relationship questions when you're making a character, one of the possibilities is we keep hurting each other. I don't have it right in front of me, but it's something like we can't help but keep hurting each other, but why do I love you anyway? And so the sub question, the hidden question is, how do we keep hurting each other? Right. And what does that, what hurts me and what hurts you? And is it related to our love or is it something that's not? And so I really like coming up with these really simple questions that make the players stop and go, huh, like really. But then sometimes you want to ask quick questions because you want them to answer quickly and get back into the game, right? So for character generation, I have more of these huh questions, but then for in the middle of gameplay, it's more quickly answer and evoke a sense of narrative positioning and then continue moving, right? So I just love that lever with questions. There's so much you can do with it. That's super fun. And it's always inviting the other person at the table to give their input, right? Like it really, I feel like when I'm writing games, I'm writing a love letter to the person I haven't met yet who's going to play the games, right? I'm just imagining what would be fun for them, what would be exciting for them. And that's really such a, I don't know, it's hard to describe how much that makes me happy, but which is why I love meeting people who play the game and say they felt like I was there. Like people who know me and have played with me later when they were playing Apocalypse Keys or Arhant, they were like, oh, Ray, it was like you were at the game with us. Like the questions that the game asked are questions you would have asked. And I was like, oh, exactly. Like, you know, that's true. So
that's so interesting. I mean, you just mentioned it very briefly there. And again, I think, you know, talking about a mechanic for 4 hours, we could easily talk about this for hours. But the idea that there's two different levels of questions, that's really, really interesting. So you can ask those questions which will literally have people, questions that people might dwell on for the rest of their lives about, you know, these self-reflective questions. But then you've got to ask those for the purposes of a game, a game session. You've got to ask succinct questions that will get people going, right, this is the next bit of the narrative. And that's so interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other thing, but what you said earlier about not being able to watch certain shows, I watched a show last night, which you definitely shouldn't watch. If you're asking questions about, you know, why do we hurt each other and why do you love me anyway? I was watching an Australian show called Bad Behaviour last night. You definitely shouldn't watch that.
Ooh. Okay, noted. Absolutely.
In the game design podcast, even questions have levels.
Yeah, right.
Well, Antonis and I, our background is in learning. So all of those facilitative questions are sort of our bread and butter.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it makes it more difficult to enjoy a simple conversation. The same, like if you're into game design, it poses a challenge to you to enjoy simply playing a game because you're thinking of mechanics and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. No, it's so true. There are times when I have friends who are just getting into TTRPGs and then they'll be like, oh, what about this game? And I'm like, Ray, you can be a normal person. You don't have to spend several minutes talking about why this is a bad game and that they shouldn't start with it. It's okay. Let them enjoy their game. There's no such thing as a bad game, ostensibly, for the most part.
Well,
I think we all have our opinions on Monopoly.
Yeah.
No, that's true, though. That's true. There's no saving Monopoly without house rules. That is correct.
Well, the history of Monopoly saves it, but the game itself was meant to cause strife.
Oh, yeah, the landlord's game is fine. Yeah, Monopoly exactly. is just a hideous bastardization. Although Monopoly Deal's quite good, the card game.
It is. I was going to bring up the card game. It is good. Yeah, it is shocking how much better it is, like that idea of shifting formats. Oh my gosh, yeah.
So speaking of being challenged to just enjoy, let's dive into the next question, which is about challenges. So what has your biggest challenge been in your game design career?
Oh, wow. I feel lucky in that I have big challenges every year that are different. And so it feels like I keep learning, and it's a really good opportunity to do so. But currently, this game that I'm working on, and it's weird, I can't talk about it. It's a one time I signed an NDA, so I can't actually talk about what the game is. It's so weird a feeling. But in general, that, and I'm also working on Twilight Throne, which is a social political game, and it especially expresses my understanding of post-colonial politics. I can talk about that one. But this other game also is pushing up against a lot of... It is a genre that is often steeped in colonialism, and the team and I are really making a concerted effort to be both post-colonial and anti-colonial. And it's... The biggest challenge I'm facing this year is internalized game structures, such as colonialism, how it's connected to ideas like individualism, and how it seeps through every part of the mechanics and the gameplay. Like, for example, when I make playbooks, I don't like creating playbooks based on archetypes. And this is something that understandably confuses people. Like, for example, with Apocalypse Keys, people were like, oh, why isn't it more like, why isn't there just a witch character or a werewolf character? Like, how do I play a werewolf in Apocalypse Keys? And I'm like, you can be a werewolf with every playbook. It just depends on what kind of werewolf you want to be. Do you want to be a werewolf that was summoned from a hell dimension that needs to create a new pact to unleash the apocalypse that's a summoned? Do you want to play a werewolf who is, you know, the last of their kind and there are no more werewolves in the world and that is your tragedy? Then you play the last. Do you want to play a werewolf that has to fight back the idea of feeding on others and you play the hungry, right? And so it basically is challenging archetypes and challenging assumptions in games, and going up against something like colonialism is so huge because there's so many systems of power that are just like built on these assumptions. Like, for example, I think like a really example in the mainstream is D&D, which is basically like, you know, a huge part colonialism, the game, right? Like, you don't question going into a dungeon and killing quotation mark monsters and taking their stuff. And, you know, it's all, you're fine. You can take it. You found it. It's okay. It doesn't matter that maybe there was another culture here that it belonged to and that you shouldn't take this stuff. But then even more subtler things like, the colonial idea of it's okay for you to go into a town and solve other people's problems, right? Like, this is, instead of like really listening to people and what do they need and respecting where they come from. And so there are so many assumptions that I have to, even like Twilight Throne, the political game, there is this weird westernized internalized idea of, oh, I have to backstab and I have to betray people in order to make it to the top. But in the post-colonial Filipino understanding is powerful people are powerful because they protect each other. And so you have to build a family of power and you have to trust each other and you have to support each other because that is what keeps the cycles in place. And I've been having such a hard time. Like, the game actively incentivizes working together and supporting each other, but ostensibly, like, with other players, there's always at least one person who's like, I'm going to backstab, even though there's absolutely no mechanical support for it, even if it will even make things more difficult. They're just thinking, I'm in a political social game, and so that's how it works, right? And that's me going like, no, that's colonialism, don't listen to it. Like, you know, right? Because colonialism is like, was built on tearing structures apart, social structures apart, in order to gain power over it, right? And so
yeah,
a huge part of colonialism is teaching people, oh, you have to go at it alone. Like, you can't trust each other, right? Because the powerful benefited from that thought, basically. So it's like thinking about big things like that and then just going like, I guess, how am I going to translate this into a PPTA move? Like going down to the small expression of it. So it's a huge challenge. Yeah, this year, definitely. It's really big.
Wow, I'm excited to see it.
So many of those expressions, those mechanical expressions of things, have also been created from within these cultural systems.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, like, for example, Bullock Bayan is so funny because it's a game about revolution, cyberpunk, right? And the interesting thing is, every single playtest, there's always at least one session, usually session 3 or 4, where all the characters will just argue about what revolution means. Like, the game will just slow down, and everyone will sit there, and people will be like, you're the saint, you control all the small gods, why don't you just make the small gods, like, destroy the corp? And then the saint will be like, I'm not going to use the small gods that way. Rebellion shouldn't be based on me destroying the small gods just so that we can have freedom. And then people are like, isn't that worth it? Like, you know, the small gods had their time. And yeah, so it's this huge, like, debate that goes on, like, what is the price of revolution? What does that mean going forward? And I'm like, wow, these are, like, big. And so a lot of my work is really just trying to make room for it structurally, mechanically, narratively. And also understand that this is where other people are coming from, right? But my friends have told me, you know, Ray, no one is expecting you to solve colonialism. Like, no one is expecting you to solve these things.
No, because I got my hopes up high.
Yeah.
But it's great, isn't it? If it makes people think, because, I mean, it's making me, my mind's going away 10 to the dozen now, because I'm even thinking now, oh, what about the terminology we actually use in games design? The idea of mechanics, the idea, you know, things like engine building, which is a mechanic I absolutely love, but it's all very much tied up in the idea of man-made machines, and the Industrial Revolution, I guess, is at the back of that somewhere, isn't it? Sort of thinking about things in a very mechanistic way.
Yeah. No, exactly. And so, yeah, people were surprised with Bullock Bayan being like, oh, why isn't there a divide between the magic and the machine? And I'm like, because there isn't. Like, there shouldn't be a divide. Like, that's a very colonial, you know, Western
thought.
Like
Terry
once
Pratchett.
Again. Yes.
Magic and science are exactly the same. Yeah.
I do love Terry Pratchett. So, yeah, absolutely. But yeah, it's really, like, challenging, but challenging people in a way that is still inviting, you know, like, really inviting them and asking them to play. And I feel like just build it slowly, like, build up. Like, I feel like we've come such a long way in terms of, like, story and collaboration. And I feel like this is another avenue that we can work on together, like, how to move past colonialism, how to effectively center marginalized experiences. Like, a lot of people call Apocalypse Keys incredibly queer, and it is, but I didn't go out of my way to make it queer. It's just queer because I am queer. And so that is how I understand the world, and so it came out in the game, right? So, yeah.
When you touch such a, well, broad topic as colonialism, is the challenge more to narrow down the complex systemic nature into the mechanics, or is it more the approach to the narrative and what you want to convey through that? Or is it both or more?
Yeah. Yeah. So for me, it's really been, so the difficulty is because these systems are in place and we're so familiar with them, we cannot imagine a world without these systems in place, right? And so even just the act of decolonization is so incredibly personal. Like, for example, because I'm from the Philippines, the idea of decolonization isn't give back our land and give us back ownership and give us stewardship, because we do own the land. But the problem is that the people in charge, most of them benefit from like generations of colonial interference and support. And so the people who look like us act like our colonial masters and have taken on their faces, right? And so really, what I have to focus on is, what does personal decolonization look like to me? Like, what is it that I am doing to move forward and imagine a world beyond these systems? And then, so then I decide, does the game make us look at these systems and then decide how to break them? Or does this game show these systems and the complexity of it and how difficult it is to break them, so that it creates more compassion in these spaces? Like, yeah, so it's really, I think it's different per game. I think I'm taking a different approach per game, but I always do have to narrow it down to a very personal perspective, because I think the act of breaking these systems, moving past these systems, is something that several artists, several people have to do together to show the different perspectives and the different facets all at once. There isn't a singular way to do it that will work for everyone. So I think the more voices we have, the more valuable, right? The clearer the possibilities become, basically.
Yeah, I guess the singular mindset would be more like colonialism instead of the opposite.
Right, also. It always comes back to it, right?
I feel this episode will be all about colonialism. And I'm all for it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
You've created a lot of games. I mean, I remember when I first discovered Our Haunts, and I went, oh, I wonder what else Ray's done. And I went and had a look on your Itch site, and it was a bit like when I discovered Funkadelic and went, I wonder if they've got a back catalogue at all. So you've got a lot of games. And you seem to embrace an awful lot of different sort of game genres and sort of mechanical approaches and so on. But I'm just wondering, apart from your own games, which other games do you like the most and why?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love games. I loved playing TTRPGs for years and years before I started making them. So it's definitely, there's so many games I love. And I feel like every year the list shifts because we have so many good games coming out all the time. It's a great problem to have. So I tried to narrow it down. I'm trying to narrow it down, but my favorites, the first one is a cheat, which is everything by Possum Creek Games. That's like a big, but mainly because Possum Creek Games is really doing so much to welcome more people into TTRPGs and into games in a very compassionate and very laid back way that I really admire. It is such a joy to play their games. I'm so proud Our Haunt is published by Possum Creek Games, because it means something. Like, it's along in that vibe, which means a lot to me. I also really love Nawal by Miguel Angel Espinoza. Nawal is, oh, if you don't know Nawal, you really have to look it up. I will just briefly say why I love it, in that it's very cathartic for me. There's like a lot of post-colonial feelings, because you play as a shape-shifting, you play as a poor Mexican, right, who has the ability to shape-shift into totem animals, and they use this power to survive, right? They're just trying to get by, and the way that they do it is to kill angels, and to turn them into like drinks or meat or something like that. So it's this very hard life that you live. And whenever I play Nawal, it feels like such a cathartic way, an empowering way to look at colonialism, but also to understand how huge it is and how huge the impact is. It means a lot to me. I love that game so much. I also really love Girl by Moonlight by Andrew Gillis because it is a Forge of the Dark game that has actions like forgive and confess. It is very beautiful. It is such a wonderful look at magical girl, the magical girl genre through various lenses. And because you can play like everything from a mecha magical girl all the way up to Sailor Moon type, all the way to a Paprika Serial Experiments Lane situation. So having that much in one game is stellar to me. I love Girl by Moonlight. I also really love Fractal Romance by Josh Hitty. This one's incredibly indie because Josh refuses to like market himself in any way whatsoever. But I love a lot of Josh's games. And Fractal Romance is great because it's just a chill hangout game. You just hang out as like weird kind of people who are maybe not people, who are maybe ideas, but you're just chilling and hanging out. And it's a very nice time. It made me realize, man, we don't have a lot of TTRPGs where you get to just chill. Usually there's a problem to solve or a challenge to face. And it's a very groovy, vibey game. And I love it. And finally, another game I have to talk about is Ma Nishtana by Gabriel Rabinowitz and Ben Bisogno. Ma Nishtana is I think the best thing I can say about Ma Nishtana is I have tried to emulate the design and I can't do it. I have failed many times. It is such a beautiful game because it is the retelling of Passover and it is supposed to feel like a communal dinner experience, but you're also retelling the story of Moses and you are encouraged to really retell it. I remember playing it with Ben and his mother and she was retelling the story of Moses's mother being like, oh yeah, she's like a Kardashian, right? Like when she was going into it, it was really good. But aside from all of that permission, what was amazing to me was in rebuilding the story of Moses, I played the game like about a dozen times by now. And each time the story is so different from the original story, but the core and the themes are always the same. And it really spoke to me on a soul level about the power of myth and legend and how even if we lose the details, the core is still there. And that's so comforting to me as someone who comes from a culture where we've lost so much of our nuance and we've lost so many details that we have, like other people have told our stories and we haven't had an opportunity to tell our own stories as part of the post-colonial trauma. But Ma Nishtana comforts me and tells me that the identity is still there. I've cried every time I've played Ma Nishtana. I've really, really loved it each and every time. And you always feel closer to the people you play afterwards, because there's this ritualistic aspect where you share personal parts about yourself. And I always feel like each time I play, I have a new family by the end of the game. So it's really beautiful. I meant to not talk too long about each game, but Ma Nishtana always makes me really talk about it. It's so beautiful and underrated. I love it so, 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 so much.
That's another long list of games that I now need to play.
I feel we're about to open up another big list, but what other game designers do you admire and you would like to see as hosts on this podcast?
Yeah, it's true. There is a big list of people I admire. I feel like we're so lucky that we're in a time when there's so many designers and so many voices. But of course, immediately the first person who comes to mind all the time is Jay Dragon, who's already been on this podcast, but I really admire Jay so much because I think Jay really taught me how to be vulnerable in your game design. I think I first heard about Jamie I first backed Sleepaway. So I first just knew Jamie as ooh, the very cool designer doing very cool things. And somehow over the years, we magically became friends, which is such a miracle to me. I never take it for granted. And I knew that when Jamie worked on Wanderhome, Jamie really poured so much of the fear of the pandemic and the disconnection and the isolation and turned it into something so beautiful. Like when you look at Wander Home, it really honors the fear and the worries it came from, but it is such a beautiful game. And it really taught me, wow, you can be really vulnerable and you can come from such a painful place, but still create something so beautiful that people will enjoy playing. Like it really inspires me so much. And also I really admire, this is someone that I'm still in the middle of like just looking from afar. I hope one day we'll become a little closer, but, I really admire V and Haley of Story Brewers. I love every panel they've been on. Every time I see them talk about games, I'm just enthralled. They're so good at it. I've been in one of the playtests for Fighting with Spirit, and I was so amazed with, I'm so amazed when people can make really good games from very light mechanics, because it comes from such a place of insight and understanding of the play experience. And I think Story Brewers are so good at that. I would love to see them on the podcast. I would love to hear them talk some more about games, because they're really amazing. They just have so much good stuff to say about games, and I think there's such a positive impact in the TTRPG space.
I totally agree with you about Wander Home. It's such a beautiful game, and I love playing it where I live as well, because it reminds me sort of like the settings and the artwork remind me. So I'm very lucky to live like on the banks of the Thames in rural Oxfordshire.
Wow, yeah.
And it just feels like, Jay, almost like new. The countryside where I live. I mean, obviously it's not true, but yeah.
But it feels like home. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the magic of Wander Home is we only have two seasons, but I believe in all of, you know, in the Philippines, but I believe in all of the seasons in Wander Home, because Jamie really, really like designed them to, I didn't understand how much seasons affect people until I played Wander Home. And I was like, oh, this is how it affects people. Like, this is what makes sense.
I, as a Greek who has moved to Germany, I can understand it.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, I love the seasons in Wander Home too. And all the festivals that go with the seasons. It's so evocative.
Yeah, so beautiful. Actually, one of my favorite mechanics from Wander Home is when you're building a new place to go to, the person who spoke the least is the one who talks about the forgotten gods. And I'm like, oh, that's so good. It's like, it's such a great meta design. That's so effortless, really beautiful.
What advice would you give to people who are just starting out in their sort of games design journey?
Yeah. So from what I've seen online, when people talk about starting games, there's so much pressure to like figure out everything before you finish making the game. And I mean, that's impossible. Like I've made about, at this point, most of them are small. I want to say that first, but we're probably around the 40 plus mark with games. Right. And I feel like I'm still learning so much, and which is fun. It's great, actually. So I feel like the way that I learned and became more confident about game design and became more confident about what I still have to learn, is I just make games and I just keep making them. Like, there's only so much I can do theoretically before I just have to write it down. I just have to create as much smoke and mirrors so that it looks enough of a real game to my playtesters, so I can trick them into thinking it's a complete game. Enough, just enough, right? Like, they know it's playtesting, but I need to help keep that, you know, that magical illusion there. And then I just go play, because just making the games you enjoy. And that's another thing too, because like a lot of people are like, oh, should I make this game? Is this what's going to sell? Is this what people are interested in? Is this what people like? I have never made a game where I thought about what other people would like, only because I trusted that if I made a game that I like, that I enjoyed, that it would, there should be other people. I'm not a unique person. So I'm sure there's someone who wants to play a tragic gay disaster of a monster, so they'll play Apocalypse Keys, right? I'm sure there are people who want to create their own homes and recreate their own memories and be ghosts and hang out in a haunted house, and then they'll play Our Haunt. So I think it's just really important to just make the games you enjoy, the games that you love, and just really enjoy the process. I feel like it's such a gift to make games because they are so much fun to play. And as many, as huge as the challenges are, even facing colonialism, it's amazing that I get to do it in the game format and it still has to be fun. It's such a good limit. It's such a good thing that you have to learn how to make a fun experience while expressing yourself. So that's what I would tell someone starting out game design. Just make the games, make what you want to play, and just enjoy yourself. It's going to be great that way.
Well, I think that naturally leads to the final question we usually ask our guests. What is a lesson that you have learned from your experience designing games that can be applied outside of games?
I think, it's funny. I thought I was going to give a different answer to this question, but I think the biggest lesson I learned was that it's important to acknowledge who you are and how you express that to the world. Like, there were so many parts of my identity and so many parts of myself that I didn't realize existed until I made games and other people brought it up. Like, I didn't realize, if you asked me if post-colonialism was important to me before I made Balik Bayan, I would have said no. But when I was designing Balik Bayan, I had all of this like colonial angst that was like coming out while I was. I also realized I was non-binary by making games. And then I realized I was a trans man by making games. Like, I didn't realize I was. So this is Our Haunt, the doll playbook. In every single playtest, I'd have at least one trans person who would say, "Wow, Ray, it's amazing that you captured the trans experience so well in the playbook." And I would say, "Wow, that's really weird because I'm not trans." And then everyone would be really quiet. And at first, I thought it was them going like, "Oh, there's this person." No. I didn't realize it was them thinking, "Oh, Ray doesn't know yet. Ray doesn't know that they're trans, right?" And you kind of have to respect that when they're in that egg stage and they haven't cracked the egg. I know that now.
So funny.
Everyone was very polite with me. But now when I look at the doll playbook, I see it, right? I see how I was really expressing how unhappy I was with the patriarchy enforcing a specific identity onto me that didn't feel real. And so there's so much of my games. Like, I didn't even realize I was a game designer who dealt with emotions and centered emotions until people started playing Apocalypse Keys and told me that. And so there's so much about myself that I discovered through games. And so I think in general, there's so much of yourself that you discovered through the act of creation, through the act of sharing yourself with others. And there's no way you're going to see it until you let other people see you.
Yeah, I've said many times in this podcast that games for me are essentially another form of art. And in many ways, they combine existing forms of art as well. And art is essentially a different language, a different way to express yourself. And by expressing yourself in a different way, you discover more about yourself.
Yeah.
So some say that if the world's most famous musicians or painters had a psychologist, they wouldn't become famous as artists. So
it's so true.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, what can you say to that, like, about games?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That is so funny. I've been seeing a therapist regularly. And she was so surprised with how well one of the tools was working. It's a narration-based tool. And she was like, "Maybe because you work on games so much and story games." And I'm like, "Yeah, that makes sense." But I do think, so I do believe that it is, how do I go about saying this? I think expressing difficult emotions is something that can come a little more easily in art. You know, like when you write breakup songs and stuff like that, it comes a little easy. I think the next step of art is when you can express positive emotions beautifully. Like, I feel like it is harder collectively as a culture to know how to express those emotions in a way that resonates. Once again, this is why Possum Creek Games and, you know, is amazing, because they know how to express a wild gamut, right, of emotions, including positive ones. And then I think the next step is taking something difficult and transmuting it into something beautiful and hopeful. Because when I first started working on Apocalypse Keys, I was in a very, it was also at the start of the pandemic. And so it was a very, you know, I don't think it was a coincidence. So many people were working on Apocalypse Games, you know, games about the end of the world around when the pandemic started. But by the end of the 3 years of me working on Apocalypse Keys, it was also a game where hope was just as important as despair and the possibility of you falling into ruin. It was just as important that you believed in your friends and you believed in love in Apocalypse Keys. And I think art and the creation of it has this ability to transmute you as well, right? Like, you transmute something in the process of creating art, and the art in response transmutes you. So I became a more hopeful person. I don't think I would have been brave enough to pursue being a trans person and to pursue medical transition in a country where it's not easy, if it wasn't for Apocalypse Keys and if it wasn't for the games I was working on, where it was important for me to, because in me telling the players, it's important that you are true to yourself, I also had to learn how to be true to myself too.
It's definitely the most unique coming out story I've heard.
Yeah, it's, can you imagine? CCRPGs helped me realize. It also helped me realize I was poly. That's another thing. Oh my gosh, that's like a, I learned all the queerness from CCRPGs.
This sounds like some kind of, you know, sort of religious right, sort of moral panic, doesn't it? TTRPGs made me gay.
They were right in the 70s.
Yes.
Funny, I play the doll a lot when I'm playing Arhorn. I play the cat as well, because I'm obviously influenced by my my compadre over here. But I always sort of, I guess you just take your own experience into it. But to me, the doll is definitely about my experience of, like, in a work situation, having to mask my ADHD.
Right.
And being that kind of, and it is
the masking
that,
required.
That whole thing. Yeah, the masking thing. That whole idea of being inside a body that's too small for you really spoke to me.
Yeah, actually, like,
about that.
What I love, because when you're designing from a, from a personal space, like, you also have to make room for the other person, right? So that you can invite them in. And I love hearing people talk about what they learned and what their experience was like. Like, hearing stuff like that makes me super, super happy to hear.
Well, Ray, it has been delightful to have you with us. I've learned about myself by talking to you. So thank you for being with us.
Yeah, I think it's definitely justified that you are the most requested future guest by our previous guests.
Oh, that's such an honor. I had so much fun being here. Thank you so much for letting me ramble. It was such a great time.
Thank you very much.
And this has been the Ludogogi Podcast.
Game over.